What I want to do is explain some of the process of moving through the grief process, and ultimately what we're moving to is reconciliation and healing, which will be tonight. You know, I'm going to do Vespers tonight, and then we will have a session to do reconciliation and healing as a way for us to experience that process. But what I want to describe for you in this session is a way of understanding, as we have worked first at identifying our grief, the second stage of identifying, once we have acknowledged the grief, is now being able to start to walk through the grief process. And a part of the discovery is that when we experience conflict or death or change, that these are natural realities that exist in our being. And the first response to that is our grief. Is how we feel about that change. Everything here is natural. Change is natural because as we parent children, the children grow, and so their needs change. And so our need as parents change, our role and our responsibility. As we grow in marriage or relationship, our relationship changes. It's a way of acknowledging that we live in an eternal now, that in the present moment we are living the full existence of being, but each moment of being creates a new opportunity, a new challenge to renew our commitment in our being. And relationships perpetually are in a state of change, that we are perpetually in a state of change, and it's our possibility in grief. It's our awareness. Our grief is our ability to recognize that change so that we are perpetually invited into new awareness, into new transformation, into new learning about who we are as people. Now, what happens at this point is that we can do three different tracks from this grief. And these are kind of the basic phenomenon, the basic ways that we as a culture and as a people have tried to deal with our grief process. One of those things is denial. And we hang on to our illusions, we refuse to accept the reality, we have numbed ourselves to our feelings. And so what we invite ourselves to do is to get off into a world of illusion and fantasy, seeking to maintain the same values from the same point of view, and remaining rigid and stuck in our perspective. And so we do not take these natural experiences and learn from these experiences. Instead, what we do is we live in denial. And what we are then left with is what we call script living. And what script living means is that we are destined to repeat We are destined to repeat the same patterns over and over and over again until we learn our lesson. See, because in essence what's happening is that conflict, death, change is a normal reality that is trying to teach us that our belief, our expectations, our preoccupations, our focus is too limited, it's too narrow. and that we are literally being challenged in our grief to learn to listen, to change the patterns, to change the belief, to change the expectation, to change the way of relating, to get more knowledge, information, education, that we literally need to transform our being. But for many of us in our culture, we tend not to acknowledge these kinds of things. And so what happens is we are stuck in a script. And so we are left in repetitive patterns. That we may change the external, so I may get one of one relationship, but when I go out to find a new relationship, what I am left with, because I have not learned from my previous experiences, I have not taken the gift of learning that was given to me, I have not taken that experience. Instead, what happens is I recycle that experience. And I go back with the old illusions and the old beliefs and the same old survival patterns that I have learned throughout my lifestyle, and I will literally repeat the patterns again and again and again until I choose to break the script. This is what we call like the serial monogamy that happens in this culture around marriage. That we believe in the value of marriage or singular relationships and fidelity, that that is a valuable primary value, but we often are not aware of how limited and how ignorant we are of not knowing how to make a relationship healthy. And so what happens is we take our old survival skills and we go out and do it again and again and again. And even though we say to ourselves consciously, there's no way that I'm going to do this the next time, and I'm looking for somebody different, as I mentioned to you last night, what science tells us is 85 to 90% of the time, we literally pick almost a perfect replication of that same kind of relationship, that same pattern of behavior. Whether that's abusiveness, whether that's neglect, whether that's inadequacy, whether that's frozen feelings, whether that's unable to perform or to function sexually, whether that's committing ourselves that we will never hit our kids again. What we know about abusive people is that unless there is intervention and change in training, that they cannot change the patterns of abuse. What becomes frightening is that most of these repetitive patterns become more severe. In other words, when we are stuck in old script living patterns, the further along we progress, the less energy we have to put into them, the more loss of self-esteem, loss of confidence because of all of the inadequacies or what we have defined as failures for ourselves. That ultimately we become sloppier and sloppier and sloppier in these choices that we make, and so the abuse becomes more progressively serious and deadly and devastating to us. So we are being invited in these kinds of experience to learn that it is the gift of the Spirit to teach us the lessons that are important for us to learn to transform our being. But if we choose to be in denial, then we choose to set ourselves up for a pattern of grief. Now, the other side of this if we get stuck, if we get stuck in our anger and depression, that we will get sick. What we tend to find is that people, that depression, we're finding now that a great many of the ailments that we have always looked to the medical profession for healing, that the medical profession is now turning back to us and saying, we are very limited in what we can do. We can provide medicinal or surgical ways of trying to help you overcome some of these things, but the origins of much of disease or dis-ease in our culture has to do with psychosocial stressors. It's a way of saying that your body is an energy field. Okay? Your body has this miraculous power within itself to heal itself. Much of what medicine is about is medicine is a way of trying to calm yourself down and give your body the time it needs to heal itself. Okay. So we may get some medications to take away some of the immediate terror and fear, but the reality is that most healing has to do with the body regenerating itself. What we find with anger and depression is that anger, when it is frozen, you know, when we are stuck in anger or we are stuck in depression, that the body, the energy that goes into the body literally locks ourselves. All experience is frozen in the body, in emotions and feeling. And so what happens is, and I want you to all, I'm going to invite you all to take your hands, and squeeze them shut like this. And I want you to keep squeezing them the whole time that I'm talking. And I want you to try to concentrate on me, but I want you to be aware of what's happening, because this is what is like what happens. It's natural when there is conflict or death or change that immediately when you don't know how to respond to it, your body withdraws into itself. It wants to protect itself. So somebody hits me, okay, you know, I feel it, and all the energy rushes to that place. Or somebody abuses me, you can feel kind of a change of spirit. When somebody puts you down, you just kind of a, kind of a loss of spirit. It's a normal process to withdraw and hold inside. Okay? Now, this is energy that goes inside and lives inside of us. But a part of the denial of our culture is to say, well, we don't want people to see this because it's not real healthy, and you can't make a good impression on people if you just if you're walking around like this all the time. So now I want you to take it and put it behind your back. And keep it back there. Okay, so now, what are you beginning to notice about your hand?
It's uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's very, very uncomfortable. But now it's not only your hand, it's your shoulder too, isn't it? And what happens to your ability to listen to the things that I'm saying? Yeah, it gets real distracting because there's a lot of energy being consumed because this is unnatural. And what literally begins to happen to this hand back here and to the shoulder is that it's normal for the body to react and to get stressed and put out energy, but it needs to have an immediate release, so the body can flow in its natural energy and take care of itself. But when we are in denial or when we are frozen in anger and rage, what literally happens is that this becomes stuck. And what I can tell you is that if we sat here long enough and hard enough, our arms would wither. We would lose the capacity to use our hands and our fingers because the blood supply is being cut off. Keep squeezing. Come on. And so what happens is that when the body is healthy, science tells us that a human body only takes 20%. When the body is healthy and the systems are open, it only takes 20% of your energy to be able to just stay alive, which means you have 80% of your energy for creativity, to go out and to become and to be whatever it is. But an unhealthy body consumes 80% of its energy just to stay alive. So when you are frozen in your grief, 80% of your energy is consumed just trying to keep the grief inside, just trying to manage and survive. Are you noticing how your energy is being consumed back here? It's getting harder to concentrate. Keep squeezing. Okay. And so what happens is you've literally cut your power of creativity, your power of transformation and being. You've literally cut it. You have decreased it by 4 times what you normally are capable of doing because you are stuck and frozen and you grieve. And so this is what happens when we get depressed, is that our energy literally gets consumed because our body is not able to heal itself because it's being blocked. And the energy can't flow when you're locked in grief like this. But then the next thing is that I'm out here trying to present an image to you, and this is where you can see the mental preoccupation, because if I want to meet you and I want to be real impressive with you, I have to put on a whole lot of energy, because really inside what I'm feeling is not very comfortable right now. My arm hurt, my fingers hurt, my shoulder hurts, and I can't concentrate, and I want to cry. But if I want to meet you, I want to impress you, so I have to put on a smile. And I have to be thinking fast, because it's not going to come naturally to me. But what happens is, when I want to meet you, the closer we get to you, what ultimately comes out is this. You want to relate to me? Yeah. How are you going to relate to me, especially when you're here? And so what you begin to see is that relationships, while we put on lots of image, when we get down to the core of the intimacy in our relationship, this is what comes out. Now, we live in a society that says, you know, look for an immediate fixation. Okay, I want you to take these hands and immediately make them work normally. Go ahead, let them go. Make them work normally. Can you work them normally?
Not too well.
No. See? Because when we are talking about years and years and years of grief, it requires patience and time. Grieving, normal grief, for example, in the loss of a relationship is 2 to 5 years. Because what happens is I have to learn to trust my body. When I've had to live like this for so many years and somebody says, no, you don't, I'm not going to trust them. It's going to take me time to build this arm back to where it had its strength. I have to literally relearn the talents and the skills, and I have to take time to nurture and stroke the energy to allow this to come back. So healing is a gentle, timeless process that requires lots of nurturing, lots of patience, lots of compassion, and lots of gentleness. But what literally happens is that if I stay this way long enough, eventually I will become sick. I will physically deteriorate. So we look at, because remember we talked about depression, that a lot of people put compulsions behind this. So not only do I have this kind of energy that's frozen in my body, but I may be also destroying my body with other things. Compulsions for food. So we have obesity as a major problem in our culture, or anorexia, or bulimic behavior. See, bulimic behavior has the way to do with our culture says be young and beautiful and supple, but at the same time you can have anything you want at any time you want, all of you want. So what you do is you try to eat it, get as much of you want, and then you go purge it somehow, get it out of your system so you still look good. But what's happening is your system is going crazy inside because it's not getting its nutrition. It's not getting natural nutrients and the vitamins and the minerals that are necessary to keep the body supple and alive and vital. When we become compulsive overeating, you know, an obese person, their body begins to feed on itself, and that it consumes a lot of energy to carry around a lot of weight. You know, if you want to know what that kind of issue is walk around for a while. Pick up a chair like this and just sling it over your back and walk around with it for an hour or so and see what an obese person has to go through to manage and maintain carrying that kind of weight around with them. Alcoholism is in epidemic proportions, all kinds of chemical addictions. We are very addicted to chemicals for energy resources. Well, if we have a body that is in desperate need of being validated, accepted, and affirmed, you know, and then we add compulsions on top of that. Chemicals distort reality. And chemicals create their own kind of insanity, because what happens is the body literally begins to change itself to accommodate and to adapt to chemicals. So now I become preoccupied with the chemicals. All mood-altering substances are toxins, meaning that they are not natural to the body system itself. So the body has to fight, literally being intoxicated from the inside out. So you have energy going with the body trying to fight toxins, the body changing, and we still have all this grief locked inside. That's why recovering from addictions is such a difficult, difficult process. Because once you take off the addiction, it's hard enough for you to go through the withdrawal and go through the process of trying to recover from addictive process, but then you've got all of that grief frozen underneath it. And when that starts to come up again, if you don't have any resources, it's why many addicted people, they want to be clean and sober, so they try to be clean and sober, but when the emotions and feelings start coming up, they can't handle it, so they end up going back. It's a lifelong transformation process. It requires a change of lifestyle. Going crazy often means in rage and anger that many people become abusive, self-abusive, they do self-destructive things to themselves, or they can't handle, they go into things with deep hope and commitment to physical abusers, sexual abusers, emotional abusers. Oftentimes when you talk to them, they feel a tremendous amount of remorse and guilt and shame, and they have a real desire to want to change, but unless they go through a healthier grief process, unless they learn to go through a healthier grief process, they are destined simply to recycle the script patterns, which will ultimately make them sick and they become very, very crazy. So these people end up continuing this pattern. Eventually what happens is they get sucked into this kind of pattern. And one of the biggest things about going crazy spiritually, and this is a pervasive illness in our culture, is loneliness. What makes a person craziest is the fear of being alone, of being abandoned, of being worthless, of being empty, of being rejected. People are desperate to somehow belong. But when they feel isolated or alone, then they literally begin to shut down their mechanisms. So we have institutions like out in Lakewood, in South Tacoma, there's Western State Hospital. See, and it used to be that the clients out there were in the 50s and 60s and years of mental deterioration, and now they have lots of young people. Young people who are so overwhelmed with the compulsiveness and the craziness, young people whose minds are burnt out because of hazardous and major drug overdoses, young people who have been violent and out of control sexually, so they have their sexual offenders program out there, are people who have been violated and mutilated by living in abusive families or somehow being victimized. And so what literally happens is that they lose their power and they shut their consciousness off and they go into a false reality because it's their only way to cope and survive. And they become frozen because when you get stuck and you progress into those levels, it's very, very hard to come back. It's very, very hard to come back. Because what I want you to hear is that people create these realities as defense mechanisms. But when you've lived with that defense mechanism for years and years and years, you know, you have lost the physical health, the physical stamina to respond to grief. You know, your mind has literally shut off into a delusional or a non-reality or into a defensiveness and a crazy-making behavior, that it takes years and years and years of intense structure and therapy for a person to be able to come back. Now, the other way, the way that you hope to learn, part of this process, and this was the stage of grief that I didn't put up there before, is acceptance. To accept that denial, anger, and depression are normal phenomena, their ways of coping, but that I need to move through the coping. Going through the coping means that I need to acknowledge and identify these stages as normal stages of being stuck when I experience conflict, death, or change in my life. And that a part of what I need then, when I have accepted these things, is also to accept the emotions that come along with these circumstances and these realities. And I need body work. I need body work, meaning I need to allow my anger, my sadness, my scare, I need to have it accepted. I need to be validated and affirmed that it's normal when I experience conflict, death, and change, that I'm angry, that I'm sad, that I'm scared, that I feel ashamed. And then what I need in that body work, first I need the validation, because part of what's important to understand in the grief process, just like this little kid throwing a tantrum I talked about earlier, is that the little kid needs to know that anger is okay and that they can flop around all they want. But also what I need is some structure. And the structure is often a way that I can go through this process but be healthy and safe. That I won't do damage to myself and I won't do damage to anything else or to anybody else. So what I need is support. And what often comes from this kind of acceptance and being able to enter into a grieving process, in this stuckness process, is I literally allow myself to share. See, this is where we get away from the loneliness. To share in an environment where I am heard. Not to just talk about it, but to share in an environment where I am heard, where my grief is heard, where I can cry the deepest cry of my being. I can sob in my pain or my shame or my guilt or my fear, and I can be heard. Where I can express my rage and my anger, and I can put it out bodily because it's physical inside, you know, that block inside. I need to put it out there so that I can release it, but it needs to be released in a healthy, safe, structured way so that I can ventilate and extend the energy and let go of the energy. But I need to do it in an environment where I can be supported. And what that means is an environment of compassion. Compassion means to suffer with. Compassion means to celebrate with. It means to have passion with. So that it means I need to be with people who understand me. And it's not people who just understand me intellectually. That's why when somebody shared before, I think it was, is it Sue? Is that your name?
Susan.
Susan? When Susan shared before, well, I want to go back and talk to my mom. See? If your mom has never gone through this thing, then she can't be a support for you because she doesn't know how to hear you. This kind of compassion is a different level of being. It's not people who just talk a talk, but it's people who have lived and become aware on a new level, a level of being. It's people who have experienced body work, the expression of anger, and who are no longer terrified of anger because they're clear on their boundaries. They know how to be safe. So they allow anger, and they're able to help support structure anger, and they are able to be there to love and affirm that person in their grief. Because a big part of this body work is letting go. The first thing I need to do in accepting my grief, first is acknowledge it. The second thing is to do body work so that I can let it go. I have to let the energy out. The energy is my energy. The grief is for me. It's not for other people. It's for me. It's for me to learn what I need. So the letting go is a step of the healing process, but I need body work, structure, and support before I can let go. Then
the next step is to transform my being.
And what I mean by transforming my being means that I listen to this body work and the letting go of this energy of what's making mad, and I am able to make decisions for me to learn from my body work that this energy, this belief, this behavior, this focus, this relationship, that these are forms of self-destruction and I need to let go. Transforming means a change of heart, a transformation. Carl Jung, a brilliant psychoanalyst, once said, after in his Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, after all of his years, and he was a very deeply spiritual being, and what he says in one of his reflections is that I have come to recognize is that there is no solution to the human dilemma. Okay. But there are only transformations to higher levels of awareness and being. That part of transformation is new awareness and new discovery that has to go through this body work, so I'm able to see in a different way, and I'm able to hear in a different way, and I am able to be empowered. When I am able to transform my perception to a new level of awareness and consciousness, then I am able to offer forgiveness. Forgiveness meaning that I am able to forgive myself and to forgive another. Now, this may sound like a real sophisticated process, but I want you to think for a moment, and this is why the blessings of children are so profound and so wonderful. Because it's like a little kid who can come up to you and say, and they ask you for something and you say no to them and they say, "I hate you." And you try to say, "Well, why do you hate me? I don't want to talk to you anymore. I don't want to listen to you. I can't see you." You know, and they're real mad, and they're getting out all their energy. And then I say, "Okay, well, you need to go do what you need to do." And okay, and they stomp off to the room. Okay. But then what happens is 5 minutes later they come back in and they ask for something else. See, and what literally happened in that time is that a kid experienced some kind of conflict and didn't get what they want. So they accepted it because they got angry. And they acknowledged their anger and they put their anger out and they stomped around and they definitely did their body work. Want you to hear about this process is that this is a tool or a way that you can look at yourself and the players and the individuals and your responses to them could change. So you could do this 3 hours from now and have a whole different group of people, whole different set of feelings. That this is just a way for you to stay clear about where you are today and help you to identify what you feel and what you need today, and the players can change. Also, a part of repression is often that you may forgive people because you think that, well, I think I've forgiven you. In essence, what you've done is simply numbed out, and so that you're not in touch with the feeling that you really need to share with them. So it may be as you discover more about yourself and your awareness, that things, feelings that you had about people, that you thought there was nothing there to be finished, and suddenly you may get a whole pile of stuff, you know, a whole pile of rage or sadness or scare, you know, around certain behaviors, situations, memories. So, you know, feelings are, you know, we're only able to deal with what our consciousness and our unconscious feels safe enough to allow to come to the present. So when you have reactions like that, it's like there's a part of you that truly does want to forgive, but there's another part of you that's still mad as hell. You know, if you want to get out the door, you know, and down the road. And it's okay to acknowledge both sides of that. And to give yourself patience to know that there may be a time when I become clearer about my focus, and then I can put them on the stage in front of me and be much clearer with my representation of what I'm feeling. Remember, these are symbolic representations, so they're your image of other people. It's not the other people. It's your memory of how they impacted you. It's the unresolved feelings inside of what's left over for you. So it's for you, it's not for them. And that's one of the ways that we tend to discount or give away, is trying to... Well, it is. It's one, it's an affirmation, because you need people. This is part of what the reality of community is about, is finding community means not just a group of people who do the same worship rituals or who, you know, or who are connected in some legal way or some community way, but rather acknowledging people that you feel validated, affirmed, accepted for yourself. But then what that allows you to do is when you can find that relationship for you or that support community for you, it also gives you an ability to understand and accept other people as human beings. So rather than seeing them as an ex-husband or wife, rather than seeing them as mom and dad, when you can get that security in you, you can look on them as beings in the process of a journey who are seeking to learn lessons in their life.
Well, what if it doesn't, look at all like that they will ever have any sort of...
Well, that's the thing, that it's important for you to acknowledge and grieve your grief. It is very sad to love somebody, but to know that they cannot accept the love. They cannot receive it because they are consumed in their own obsessions, consumed in their own grief, and they are stuck in their own denial. So that the love you hold for them can be a compassionate love, but realistically you also have to detach from them. You have to be able to say, I must remain vital and alive, and I am deeply saddened that you cannot experience love the way that I know I have to give it to you. I will love you unconditionally, but I will accept your reality that you can't respond, that I must turn to other people who I know can hear me, can see me. See, and that's the miracle of this process, the example of Christ. See, the example of Christ is that when people brought in people consumed by evil spirit, people who are crazy, Christ is able to stand there in his divine wisdom and compassion and demand that those spirits leave this body. Most other people, if somebody came in here and were going into an epileptic seizure or just going mad, running around the room, saying abusive, destructive things, most of us would be terrified. And so we'd want to run and go hide. But Christ, in that divine wisdom, is able to have a deep, deep sense of compassion to acknowledge and want to be angry at and express an anger, get out, leave this being. Because Christ is able to see the inherent goodness of this man and wants to call that evil energy, wants to call the despair, the depression, the craziness, the sickness. You know, whenever there are symbols and messages in the gospel where Christ is, where Christ runs into somebody who is sick or depressed, it always says just before he does some kind of, whether it's healing, It says Christ turns and sees them and is moved with compassion. See, that's the greater wisdom, is that Christ is moved with compassion and then is able to intervene. On the other hand, Christ turns to Peter and says, "Get away from me, Satan." Christ turns to the Pharisees and, "You blind hypocrites, you who talk but can't see, you who listen but can't hear." And what Christ is doing is using his grief, his healthy grief, rage and anger, and turning to people in denial and saying, "You don't even know what you're talking about. You don't know. All of this intellectual crap and your legalism is blind. You can't see. Where is your compassion?" See, so Christ is trying to divine, and that's a part of being healthy. When I can be angry at a parent or a spouse, but be angry because of my compassion, standing of the spirit and the power of love within me, then I can face what I see to be destructive in my world or environment. And I can challenge it. But again, the core of it is that I have to stay healthy with me. What our trouble is in this culture, especially in Christian tradition, because we've always had the sense of love your neighbor and help your neighbor. So the idea is that we have the illusion that if somebody's in trouble, we have to get into it with them and we have to make them better. See, we don't have the power to make them better. Christ's life is filled with examples where he got exhausted and overwhelmed with all the sick people. And there were hundreds of people who said, "Come eat with me. Come heal me. Come talk to me." And he says, "Well, I need to get in the boat, so we need to go over here. And maybe we can go somewhere else. And no, I'm not going to stay here. I'm going to sleep out under the stars because I need some time for meditation and I need to get connected. I need to get connected with God." See, that Christ functioned on a different level of awareness, a divine awareness. Most of us don't understand that. So, and that's a part of it, is because, the second thing I wanted to say was, we're talking about single parenting. And what I want you to hear is that the essence of parenting is that when you can learn this process for you, then you can be a model and example and teach it to your children. So that your children learn healthy values, your children learn healthy grief, your children learn compassion and forgiveness. You can't teach this to them if it's not an experience for them. So this is why it's so essential and important that you become aware of this process for you. And why scripturally and what Christ does is validate that this is a universal phenomenon. It is the way and the light and the life. See, and when you follow in that light, the power is within you. But we need to get out of the way. We need to break our illusions. We need to get unstuck. We need to challenge ourselves to understand that the Spirit is within. To understand that acceptance, that loneliness is not like that if I have to go in and discover this, I'm going to be some alienated being out there. But rather to recognize that when I discover this and I come to community and share it, I discover that this Spirit and the power is here and alive all over, all the time. It's just that we don't make time for it. We live in this world of illusion. Or we stay preoccupied in our own depression or our rage or our compulsion.
It's been real important for me this year of adjusting to single parenting to invite Christ. I cannot unstick myself. I can work at it, and I can spin my wheels a lot. But when I have seen progress, there have been the times when I have gone into prayer and solitude and said, "Lord, I really don't have to deal with my loneliness, my inadequacy of meeting my children's demands.
give me new eyes to see your way, new ears to hear your voice. Be my servant and my courage. I think that's a real resource that we never get.
Thank you.
As somebody who's been probably at times feeling like I was on that, right in that crazy area, and I think that was coming out of the that need to be, that sense of responsibility that I'd be in control to be able to care for those that I was concerned about, most specifically my kids, and at one time with my wife. And it's good to hear and to get this confirmation again that it, and have it pointed out.
And this is all for you. And you have the power within you. You have the power to overcome sin. And you have the power to overcome evil. But you need to be willing to walk through the process. I am giving to you what my Father has given to me. So the joy that I feel inside can be yours, and your joy can be complete. The Spirit, the Father, lives and works and loves within you as well as within me. I no longer call you my servants. I call you my friends, because a servant doesn't know what his master is about. Christ is trying to educate us and say, you have the power and the possibility. If you would only love my Father with your whole heart, your whole soul, your whole being. And what Christ is literally saying is allow your whole being to be open to the experience that is available to you, to the spirit of life and energy that is available to you. Over the years, what we have done is we have redefined that into a passive, powerless state. That's been the sadness, is that we have created a sense of victimization and powerlessness. It's like Christ is perpetually inviting us to discover our own spiritual power and energy. And for some reason, we as humanity continue to try to deny that. And we don't want it. We still want magical cures out there. We still want someone out there to somehow come in and zap it to make it better. We still want someone to fix it. And so we've redefined a lot of the responsiveness of our spiritual journey as being a journey of suffering, that we have to suffer for the sake of suffering, and we need to be victims or we need to be martyred. And that's not the truth. I can be in a difficult, painful situation and stay healthy if I know how to be clear and take care of myself.
It's kind of that different though than what Cheryl's talking about. That's where it took a minute of time that I get confused. Between inviting Christ in and having him be supportive, or turning over the victim. To be a victim. It's in that choice right there that it gets real good.
Inviting Christ in and discovering our power is one and the same thing. When I invite Christ into my life, what do I feel? What's the feeling you feel? What's the feeling you feel when you invite Christ into your life? But what's the feeling you feel in your being? In the very gift of your being that the Father has given you, there are resources and power. And you need to understand this power, that it is from the Father, from the Mother to you. But you are responsible for that power. And what we have a tendency to do is continue to look outside. Inviting Christ into my life is acknowledging Christ in the presence and the power of Christ within our life. But I still have a responsibility. I have to make that power known. I have to acknowledge and validate and affirm. What often happens in laying down our life for our friends is that we don't do that from a state of power. We don't do that from a point of view of wisdom as Christ would intend laying down his life. But rather we do that from a state of powerlessness and victimization. And so we do it with good intention, but it becomes self-destructive and self-defeating. And that's what kills us in the process. Laying down my life, it's just like going up and saying to somebody who's threatened my life, I feel sad and angry and I want to forgive you for threatening my life, just in the moment when they raise their sword and kill me. If I went with the hope of transforming that person's life, I live in illusion. If I need to express that for me, I need to express it for me, but I also need to express it in a way that's clear and understanding, you know, that I don't need to go face the sword when I know clearly that that person's intent is to kill me. That I can be powerful in my forgiveness of that person without having to be there. And that's what happens in relationships so often, is that we have a tendency and a need to want to stay there, to want to be there, to want to make it happen, believing that if I perpetually am trying to forgive this person that they will be healed or they will understand. How many of you have done that in a relationship? Tried to forgive a person thinking one of these days they're going to understand and they're going to recognize how forgiving that I have been to them and they're going to appreciate me. And that becomes an illusion. That's a part of a hope that we hang on to. See, laying down your life is much different. It's more a sense of responsibility, the ability to respond with clarity and power, so that I am able to be honest and confront them. I can love you as a being because I have invested much in you, but your behaviors are destructive and abusive, they're frightening. And I cannot allow myself to be a part of your victim. I will not perpetuate your behavior by being a victim for you. Christ's choice to go to the cross was not to be a victim of evil. Christ's choice was a different choice. It was a choice to overcome. It was to overcome power by allowing those people to believe that they had the power over Christ to crucify and kill him. And yet it came out of a deeper awareness in Christ that by his dying, he was giving birth to something that was so vital and so powerful. And his awareness that it was those people and those beliefs that would die. He says, in time, there will not be stone left on stone in this place. But the Spirit will live forever. It will take you hundreds of years to rebuild this temple, and I will rebuild this one in 3 days. See, in essence, a part of this is a way of saying that there is a compassion and a grief and a forgiveness that is a part of a spiritual power. And you people are all preoccupied with all the external stuff. And you don't understand that that's not what's real. That's not what's important. It's what's in here.
You're saying power is from God. You're saying power is God. God gives us power that we can kind of cultivate within ourselves, but the power of you is actually God, right?
Sure, it's God, but it's God from God through us. But we have a choice.
From God through Christ.
We have a choice. From God through Christ through us. We are a living manifestation of the power of love in the universe. But God, in his benevolence and love, has chosen to give us the freedom to choose how we use that power. And we have the choice to use it for evil purposes, for destructive purposes, or we have the power to use it as a means of transformation, of creativity, of becoming. But there is a power within us, there is a choice. And that's what Christ was saying to us. You do have the power. I've made known to you all that my Father has made known to me. See, but there's a real resistance within us, because one of the things about being a powerful person is that you have to be a responsible person. See, there's something safe and secure about keeping it out there and wanting it to be out there. Because then I don't have to take responsibility for it. I don't have to discipline myself. I don't have to listen. I don't have to do all this hard work to meditate. I don't have to go through this very, very difficult grieving process. And it's not magic. There are things, there is a power God manifests in all of creation, that there are lots of things that can bring power to me. But Christ is trying to say there is so much more that's available to you within you. But you have to get out of the way and allow it to be. And that's inviting Christ into your life.
I'd like to say a word about power, because Christ did not want to be the powerful king and ruler that others saw him. His power was to love and to be, to understand, and to see. So our understanding of power might be quite different from Christ's understanding.
Now we need to break for lunch. What I want to ask you to meditate on is that what we experienced this morning was a focusing and a becoming aware of our grief process. So what you did in that meditation and exercise was to look at the individuals in your life so you can identify your grief and begin to see where you are in the grieving process. This evening, a part of what reconciliation and forgiveness will be to reverse that process. Meaning that now you will have a chance to think about, and what I would like you to meditate on this afternoon, what are the things about yourself and your being that you need forgiveness for? That you need to ask their forgiveness? That you need to ask for God's forgiveness or Christ's forgiveness? So you might reflect upon the things of your life, of your behavior, of your choices. I think you would mention some of those things. Things that are that you feel guilty about, or feel shameful about, limits or fears or abuses or ways that you have been stuck in here that you need forgiveness about. And bring that with you as you come through the reconciliation tonight. And that's what we